At Parker, our purpose is simple. We want to make the world a better place. By working more efficiently, by using more sustainable practices, by developing better technologies, we keep moving forward. With each new idea, innovation, and partnership, we're one step closer to fulfilling our purpose every single day. To find out more, visit parker.com/purpose. Parker, engineering your success.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to another edition of WrestleNomics Radio. I'm Brandon Thurston, broadcasting live and on demand from Buffalo, New York, where today is Sunday, June 26th, 2022. It is officially summer. I don't know when summer starts, 19th, 20th, 21st, 22nd, one of those days, and it's now in the past. And here we are, joining me from my immediate south, from South Buffalo, Chris Gull.
Hello. Beautiful weekend weather-wise here in the Buffalo, New York area, but it's a beautiful morning to talk about the wrestling business. It's Forbidden Door Day. I was going to say Forbidden Boar, but Forbidden Door Day, as that pay-per-view will be later this evening. But we're going to talk a lot about it. We're going to talk about Forbidden Door a little bit, but we're actually going to discuss the effects of the Wall Street Journal article with Vince McMahon and the scandal surrounding it. Wow. As far as TV ratings, stock prices. We got some news and notes regarding that.
Yes. I don't know who wrote this video title, this podcast title today. Effects, coincidences, correlations. I don't know if it's an effect. You can't necessarily say cause and effect, but we'll see. Yes, it's warm today. We've decided that we are going to AEW in Rochester, which is two Wednesdays from now, I think, right?
Mm-hmm.
We do not have comps. We're not accepting media comps. Despite Golo's urgency that we get free tickets from his friend, the first name Tony, I said no. We are paying for our tickets, so we will be going there. So where should we begin? There's a chart with TV ratings on the big screen right now.
Yeah, here. So we're going to talk here about viewership. You didn't lead off with the lead screen, though, the New York Stock Exchange with Vince McMahon.
No, we'll get to that, though. Okay. I know you want to focus on that because that's the negative story for Vince, right? But big TV ratings for SmackDown, two SmackDowns ago. We do have a prelim rating for Friday's SmackDown, but a really big rating for Raw. A really big rating for SmackDown, which had to be adjusted, by the way. Did you see that? That Nielsen reissued their data?
I did see a little quib about that, a little quib.
Where should we begin here? We can say that SmackDown, if we have like the little chart here, the little gauges, SmackDown on Friday the 17th, so 2.39 million viewers, almost 2.4 million. So that's about what I had projected based on the prelim. Then the rating came out quite a bit lower, just over 2.2, which was, I was surprised at how low it was based on the prelim. I was actually at the ESW show. I got the prelim and I was like doing the math on my phone with the calculator app, like, you know, multiplying it by 1.055 or something. And I was surprised at how low it was. So on Friday, not on Friday, but on, I think on Thursday, Nielsen recognized that it had undercounted or not counted out of home viewing, which is a relatively new invention of Nielsen to count viewership that's happening outside of the home. And I guess that means in like bars and public places and maybe just Nielsen people that are watching TV at somebody else's house or something like that. But anyway, they adjusted their ratings. This also adjusted the all-time low Rampage to no longer be the lowest Rampage of all time, even including preemptions, but to merely be the least viewed Rampage of all time in the normal time slot. So there are a few preemptions that were less viewed for Rampage, including just one in the demo and four in total viewership. A few preemptions that were less viewed than the Rampage on Friday, June 17th. We don't know what the Rampage did for Friday, but SmackDown was up, and if people are watching on YouTube, you can see over on the far right the columns that compare this rating versus the median of the last 4 weeks, which is my favorite way to look at what's this thing been doing lately. I don't like to just look at what it did for the prior week. I do write that in the reports on Patreon. But I like to, because who knows what happened last week, and who knows if the reader remembers whether last week was a huge rating or not. So I like to take a median of the last four. Anyway, SmackDown was up in the demo 39%. Big pop. Up in total viewership, 24%. A 0.62 in the demo. 2.4 million viewers. This was with the advertised appearance of Vince McMahon. Very short, as we've looked at in the quarter hours. Have we looked at it in the quarter hours? I don't think we have here. Maybe we did. I don't know if we did it all, really. But actually, the Reigns and Riddle match had higher viewership than the Vince segment, which was very short and at the very start of the show. So the quarter hours, which are on Patreon, and I tweeted them at the time, too, and I've since the Nielsen adjustment, I've tweeted updated versions of the, and I have not tweeted them, but they are on Patreon, the updated versions of the quarter hours. The Nielsen adjustment reissue of data does not change the trend. It merely just bumps everybody up by about the same degree. But surprising that the Reigns and Riddle match was more highly viewed than the Vince segment. So I don't know if people tuned in as the show went on and wondering if Vince was going to come back or what. Nonetheless, the day that Vince, it was announced that Vince was stepping down, stepping aside, however you want to put it, still remaining the head of creative. But on the day that was announced, they did a big rating for SmackDown as they advertised that he would be on SmackDown. You figured that would be it. But then, lo and behold, on Monday, with no advertisement, no advertisement ahead of time before the show, no advertisement during the show. It's not like they said during Raw, coming up later, Vince McMahon. But just he showed up as a surprise. And still, Raw was up in the demo by 27%, up in total viewership by 16%. So not as big of a bump as SmackDown got with its advertised appearance of Vince and its advertised match between Riddle, don't say his first name, and Roman Reigns, but still a pretty strong bump. So that must be the end of it. And why is that happening? We'll get to that in a moment. And then you figure that's the end of it. But then the next night, NXT. I don't know that people were expecting Vince to show up on NXT. It was a tape show anyway. Not that people are probably thinking about investigating it that deeply. But anyway, NXT up 41% in the demo, up 10% in total viewership, doing a 0.18 in the demo. Its highest, I don't have it on me right now, but you know, Raw and NXT here doing their highest ratings in quite a long time. Why is that happening? I was told all TV is down, and you know, so this is extra impressive then, I guess, if it's true that a wider trend in wider decrease in viewership generally is affecting all programming generally, then this would be even more impressive if that's true, and we'll entertain that in a moment. But anyway, what do you think's happening here?
Well, WWE is making mainstream news, you know, and people are curious. Part of people have watched forever. It's like, oh, it's Vince McMahon scandal. What is going on here? And then you see, and I mean, the Friday thing with, hey, Vince is going to be on SmackDown, that just even created it more. And I think people are just generally tuning in because they want to see what's really going on in the product, as it's a public scandal right now.
Is it, as our friend Eric Bischoff would say, controversy creates cash. There's no such thing as bad publicity.
Yeah.
I don't know. My description would be that this mainstream news story is putting Vince McMahon more at top of mind. Really surprising, though, that even in an NXT's case, that this coincided with a big increase in NXT viewership. So there's that, and we have the gauges here, but that tells largely the same story. I guess we could talk about the dine of the AEW ratings a bit. You can see too, I guess, in certain demos, and I don't have this across all the demos for SmackDown and for Rampage at the moment, because these are the ratings that were updated for Friday for the Nielsen reissue of data. So I only have demo and total, but for the others, we can see sort of what demos increased the most versus the prior 4 weeks. NXT's breaking the gauges all the way across. It's especially younger viewers that increased. Certainly in NXT's case, that one is up 56%, which is more than the other demos that are on the screen, including 18 to 49 and men and women separated in 18 to 49. In the case of Raw, not so much 18 to 34. Women were way up, 44%, more so than men were up. I would guess it's just the people who sometimes watch Raw, and I've heard this described in different ways. So, like, I've heard it described in sort of the traditional wrestling fan dichotomy way, in that, wow, new fans, casual fans are checking it out. And I think maybe a more apt narrative is that there's lots of people. There's this big funnel of people who watch WWE TV, let's say. And people really far down in the funnel down here, they watch it every week. And then there's people further up the funnel who watch it, you know, once a month, you know, a couple times a month. There's people way up at the top of the funnel who watch it a couple times a year. And my narrative would be that, my guess is that people thought about WWE more, thought about Vince McMahon more in the last, you know, 7 days or so before these programs, and that put WWE more top of mind for people, and that resulted in some people watching it who usually don't, who are on those higher, in that higher end of the funnel. So I think that's what happened there. So I don't think it's so much as like people who never watch WWE or never watched WWE checked it out, so much as, sure, there's probably some of that, so much as people who infrequently watch WWE watched it this week, this past week. What else? We do have a prelim rating for SmackDown two nights ago, as we speak here today. Looking like it's going to do about 2.24 million viewers. What does that mean in some sort of meaningful context? That means that this was still a pretty high rating. SmackDown did some pretty low ratings. Granted, it was going against NBA playoffs during that time. And the time before that may be enhanced just by it's sort of the WrestleMania season. So, but anyway, what I would say about this prelim rating is that this is still a really good rating for SmackDown relative to what my expectations would be. Is there a sustained effect here? The final rating for SmackDown will come out on Monday. The rating for Raw will come out on Tuesday as usual, and we'll see what happens. I do expect, though, a week from now, Monday, July 4th, Raw to have a very low rating. Some of the lowest ratings that Raw has ever had have been on or around July 4th.
This Monday is 20 years of Cena, so I imagine there's going to be just a bump up from that.
That's what Vince is there to remind everybody.
Yeah.
Of. By the way, if people want to do a super chat.
Yeah, I was just going to lead into after we're done with that. But yeah, right there on your YouTube, you click the dollar sign with your question, put any amount that you seem fit for that question, and we'll answer it throughout the show. If it's about the topic at hand, we'll answer it around that time period. If not, we'll definitely get to it towards the end of the show.
Right. So, where else should we go here? If we look at, we might as well look at this. So, All TV is down, as you may have heard. I was surprised to find Dave Meltzer mentioning that I had mentioned a couple weeks ago that the 2 weeks ago Wednesday, so that's June 12th, when Dynamite did a 0.28 in the demo, which I believe was their lowest demo since like May 2021, more than a year if I'm remembering that correctly. Anyway, Dynamite did a very low rating two Wednesdays ago. They a 0.28. They did a little better this past Wednesday, 0.31. And in fact, we probably have that on the screen here. What, yeah, 0.31 and 878,000 viewers, which was lower than the median of the last 4 weeks, but a lot better than the week prior. And what I can show you is this. So what we have here is year-to-date. Here's every week year-to-date with the demo per 60 minutes. Good Lord, what does that mean? Without getting into, like, really confusing granularity, this is basically a typical demo rating for an hour program based on the cable originals that we get from Showbiz. So no broadcast in here, just cable originals. And we do see, you know, on that Wednesday did a 0.07. This past Wednesday also did a 0.07. Year to date, there's no other 0.07 here. I'm not looking super far back, but I would not expect that it's going to be lower going far back as engagement with linear TV just declines over time. Is that the case for other days of the week here recently? We are missing a Showbiz data point from last week Friday. For whatever reason, they didn't post all 150 other telecast rows. But we do see, you know, everything looks to be down pretty sharply. I guess you look at Sunday with the 0.06s. There is a 0.05 back here. The 0.07 on this past Monday, which is the day that Raw did a really good rating. And you could excuse that. Well, it's an exceptional circumstance because of this story surrounding Vince. I don't know. That's what total viewership looks like. Total viewership is not as dire looking as the demo is. Nonetheless, I did do... What is this? This is just showing across the years, but let's look at this. So I did do a correlation chart here and tested the R-squared to ask the question, you know, okay, let's look at Dynamite in the demo, and let's look at the top 50 cable originals, and is there a relationship in terms of if TV generally, and when I say TV generally, we're referring to the top 50 cable originals that we can get from Showbiz Daily. The question is, as that general measurement is higher, does the Dynamite rating get higher? And the answer is, at least based on this, no. There's no relationship here. It's pretty random. Now, we do see way down, you know, on some really exceptional cases where the top 50 cable originals did, you know, almost 300% better than usual compared to the trailing 90 days. We did see a lower than usual Dynamite rating. And back here, when it did 150% better than usual, did see, you know, a 30% lower than usual Dynamite rating. But it's not as if this is a positive trend in terms of this line is not going up and to the right. This line is going down to the right. So as general viewership gets higher relative to the trailing 90 days, it doesn't look like it's reliably the case that Dynamite ratings in the demo get better. Does that make sense? You following me here, Gull?
Yeah, I mean, and I would imagine that the dip in this time period would be the summer, but really you can't really blame the summer on the drop of AEW's ratings into a larger context.
So that's what these tables are showing here. Look, there is seasonality to television viewership. If we're looking at every year, 2016 to the present, and what we do see is in June, July, August, you know, the average over these years is 0.15. So it's got the weakest average over these, what is this, like 7 years? There is seasonality happening here. When it's the summer, and we love this excuse on the indies, oh, you can't draw in the summer. People don't want to participate in indoor entertainment in the summer.
You can't run July. That was
like for you. Absolutely not. Do not run in July. June, okay. August, okay. But there's something to that, right? I mean, look, the people are watching television less. At least in the demo. Is that true in terms of total viewership? Let's look. Yeah, that's somewhat true in terms of total viewership, too. Based on the Showbiz data, which is not everything. I don't have a Nielsen subscription. But this is based on all the data that I've gotten from Showbiz Daily. And this is cable originals only, but if I include broadcast, I would expect a similar result. There is some seasonality in the summer. But it's not as if there's this strong relationship correlation between what that general measurement of television viewership is doing and what Dynamite is doing. This on this chart with the orange dots, I'm just looking at primetime, and it's no stronger. It's just as random with these. Yeah, I would expect that maybe in these really exceptional situations, like where you've got enormously high viewership for something like the coverage of the January 6, 2021 news story, that was on a Wednesday. And as I recall, that crushed NXT and Dynamite, which were both on Wednesday at that time. So, you know, I would theorize that maybe you want viewership to be kind of normal relative to what it usually is. But anyway, not a really great, not a predictable relationship here at all, mathematically. I wrote a piece on Patreon this past week about Rampage, and that Dynamite's holding up okay, especially if we look at the rank, which I think is the most reliable and least misleading metric to look at. So we're looking at here is the daily PTN 49 rank among cable originals, which everybody can see on Showbiz Daily. And I've merely taken that data and put it on a chart for Dynamite in the gray, for Rampage in the orange. And we see, you know, Dynamite's doing, if nothing, you know, only doing better over time, especially that coincides with April 2021 here, where they're no longer going against NXT. But they're staying in mostly the top five and always the top 10 since April 2021, the end of the Wednesday Night War. At other times, they were falling as low as into the 30s, on a couple of occasions, the 40s, the 50s, around the 2020 election. That's why it was so low that time. But Rampage, which started out really strongly, especially with the enormous CM Punk episode in episode number 2, strong September, as we all remember, for viewership for Dynamite. But Rampage has really fallen in a way that I don't think can be excused by any external factor other than it's become a less important show for viewers. Viewers feel like it's a less important show for them to watch. I don't see a real conclusion to draw here other than that. It doesn't help that AEW has lost CM Punk of late, but it was going down before then. As you can see in this sort of dotted orange line, especially from about January or so, it takes a really sharp dip. It's recovered a little bit, but it's still hanging around here in the just under the top 10, around the 15 to 20 mark, which is considerably below where it was before. Is this the end of the world? Is AEW going out of business? Probably not. But it's not as strong as it once was. And it's not just that it's not as strong as it was in August and September in the CM Punk and Bryan Danielson debut era. It's not as strong as it was in December or even February or January, that time period. So we're not comparing it to this super strong peak that, of course, it fell down from. But we're comparing it to months after CM Punk's debut. A lot of this, I think, has to do with the preemptions. So Rampage has been preempted 7 out of 24 times year to date. That's almost one third of the time. I feel like I said this recently somewhere, but
yeah, we were just talking about, because you were thinking that in the next TV rights deal, maybe Rampage should get moved to a streaming service. I know last time we talked about this, yeah.
Yeah, so I think it would be better because they're never going to be, the Rampage is never going to take the precedent over college basketball, over NBA playoffs, over NHL playoffs even. So I think it would be better to have Rampage sold to a streaming partner where presumably they could air wherever it's best for it to air and not have to worry about being preempted and not favored over other programming. But anyway, is that all? I think that's all. Anything to add there? Question?
Nothing too much. I know there was some comments on the Vince McMahon on Raw YouTube that we have some slides for.
Yeah, as we
kind of backtrack a little bit.
As we jump around chaotically, as if this is an AEW TV taping or something. and we'll talk about the stock next after this, but so the YouTube clips for these Vince appearances, the one on SmackDown, comments were disabled. The one on Raw, comments were not disabled. Now, they may have been moderating it, but if you really want to lose hope in humanity, read for us some of the comments that were, these are the top voted comments on the YouTube clip.
Mr. McMahon's transformation into Mr. Burns is 85% complete. Damn, he seems more celebrated than before, LOL. He's definitely not hiding from the spotlight. Even Vince got older and exhausting, but he still kept entertaining WWE fans. Big respect to him. No one so far deserves such respect from WWE management, one and only John Cena.
Yeah,
you can tell Vince is just embracing his last moments at the company. He's definitely looking like personally he feels he needs a rest. Haven't heard hustle, loyalty, and respect in so long. Regardless of what's happening behind the curtains, I'm very glad to see Vince back for one last sparkling. He still got it. Cena and Vince are like the ultimate combination for success.
I'm glad you're here for another sparkling, Chris Cullo.
Looking at the YouTube channel, a lot of people are glad I'm here in my creamsicle themed shirt today and bow tie combo. The man who innovated a company that will go on forever. And to quote Terry Funk, forever. That wasn't the Terry Funk part, wasn't it? You can see me. You can't see me because my time is now is his best line. This is like when the popular kid is suspended from school, but he keeps turning up every day to hang out with recess with everyone. I like that one. Man, looking at Vince's physical appearance, you realize how fast the years have gone by. Glad to see him once again. Feels like Vince McMahon is like a little kid his last day of school. That's the vibe. And then this is great. Always had the best in embracing the villain role. I love that he should keep doing this. He's like a heel who's also over with the crowd. Genius. See, and not a lot of anti-Vince McMahon sentiment on there.
Now, maybe what we've really done is, you know, maybe WWE has, orchestrated their alleged bots and placed these comments. And maybe they've moderated other ones that perhaps did get thumbs upped. And but WWE Digital Media didn't want on there. But who knows? And maybe we're just reading propaganda here. Nonetheless, I guess it's worth pointing out this all aligns with what I think is a desirable outcome for WWE, and somewhat explains why he was on television in the first place. Just go out there, show normalcy, and this is exactly the response that they want. In that, hey, maybe there's problems here, but he's going out there and showing that everything's okay. Everybody's glad to see him, and you can see that on television in terms of where the director chooses to put the camera. They choose to put the camera on people who are cheering him. Vince slapping hands on the way out of SmackDown. Just show that everything is normal. Nothing's going to change. So anyway, something that did change, though, is W stock, which we have here for people watching on YouTube. The stock was down while indexes were up since last week Wednesday, which is when the Wall Street Journal report came out. So from that time onward, even the stock market generally year to date is approaching bear territory. There's been a little bit of a rally since last week Wednesday, where the indexes are actually up by, you know, in the case of the NASDAQ, up almost 5%, Dow Jones and S&P up maybe 2 or 3%. Again, from Wednesday, June 15th, which is the day that the Wall Street Journal story broke. This is the day that any of this was reported for the first time. And then he stepped aside as CEO and chairman on Friday with Stephanie in his place on an interim basis. The stock, WWE, over the same period of time as the close of the market on Friday, is down almost 10%. Again, while the indexes, a measure of the stock market generally, is up a few percent. This is, you know, it was $67 on Wednesday, the close of the market, before the Wall Street Journal story broke, just after the close of the market, $67 per share. Now at 60 still. It did fall below 60 for a moment, I believe on Thursday, but it did have a little bit of a rally on Friday. I've been watching this and sort of tweeting the chart every day at the close of the market or during the market. And just seeing it was underperforming the stock market indexes. So there's that. Have you heard about the XFL lawsuit?
Yes, the wrongful termination from Oliver Luck lawsuit. Yeah,
does that appear to be heading to trial? It's going to trial, right?
No, they settled out.
They settled out of court, apparently. Oliver Luck, who was the former XFL commissioner in the relaunched 2020 version of the XFL, Vince fired him. Oliver Luck was suing for wrongful termination, trying to get something in the neighborhood of $25 million out of Vince. These are filings that I was, you know, getting alerts for the last couple years or so here. They looked to be about to go to trial. I think that was the latest we knew, and probably just before the Wall Street Journal story broke. But then we have... I saw Mike Johnson of PW Insider reference a filing and report that the lawsuit had been settled, that there was an agreement between the plaintiff and defendant, and they were settling out of court. I didn't understand what in the filing made that clear. I asked all the attorneys involved, and Oliver Luck's attorney, one of his attorneys, did tell me that it had been settled. And what was the comment? We wish them well in their future endeavors. Yes. I don't know if they knew the meaning of that has in the wrestling business or not, but that was the comment. So that's being settled. We'll bring this up. Why don't you read this report from PW Insider about the MLW lawsuit between MLW and WWE.
Yep. During a post-battle Riot 4 media scrum, I asked MLW CEO Kurt Bauer whether MLW had been approached by settling their lawsuit with WWE in the wake of the allegations and the investigation into Vince McMahon, as McMahon and Oliver Luck have settled their lawsuit related to the XFL. Bauer stated, "No comment. I can't comment on the pending legal other than we are looking forward to our day in court as we are going through the process. I continue to be increasingly optimistic that when we get to court, it's going to be favoring court." So,
yes. So that's consistent with other comments that Kurt Bauer of MLW has made, in that they're eager to see this case go to trial. So there was a filing, which I don't think I have in here. There was a filing this past week that it looks like MLW, if I understand the filing correctly, MLW is trying to get a decision about discovery made sooner rather than later. I believe they have a September 29th date where they're supposed to, I believe, decide whether discovery happens or not. Or whether this case goes to trial or not. And my layman reading of the filing is that MLW wants the judge, the court, to make a decision about whether or not discovery is going to happen before then, so that they can start discovery now. What is discovery other than a channel in the Warner Brothers Discovery universe?
I mean, isn't that basically like pre-trial? With that, all the records have to be shown and be public and whatnot for the trial.
Yes, you start gathering evidence and making that public record. And it was also suggested to me by, you know, someone who I was just trying to understand this with, that, you know, maybe what's happening here with the XFL, the Oliver Luck lawsuit being settled, maybe MLW sort of observing this, trying to push things along even quicker, and maybe push WWE to settle, so that WWE will avoid having Vince McMahon deposed, where he would be questioned under oath, and that the leeway for what a subject can be asked when they're deposed is greater than it is when they're on trial. So maybe questions related to this board of directors investigation could come up. Maybe that's what's happening here. Again, we don't know the details of the settlement between Oliver Luck and Vince McMahon. And to be clear, that's a lawsuit between Vince / Alpha Entertainment and Oliver Luck. That doesn't directly have anything to do with WWE, not directly. But the MLW lawsuit is a lawsuit against WWE, which was filed back in January, because MLW alleges that WWE interfered with their media deals, including a deal that they were making with Tubi. So, yeah, that's what's happening there. And what else do we have here? A number of shareholder lawsuits. All the sharks are swimming in the water here. We've got upwards of 7 law firms. We're looking at class action shareholder lawsuits. There's an 8th. lots of that going on. I wouldn't be surprised if there's more that even emerge. And anything else to add before we move to the Wall Street Journal had a podcast earlier this week?
Nothing really regarding Vince and settlements and all that. I do think that that's what MLW is doing. They're pushing for a good settlement because, I mean, they got bigger fish to fry, right? Vince McMahon and them dealing with the scandal. So let's just get this over with and get this done.
Go ahead, finish.
Or just say pushing the idea for court is probably the last thing that Vince McMahon and them want to do right now when they're dealing with everything else.
It could spread McDivitt thin. Lawyer, Jerry McDivitt. I should mention, we don't know the details of the settlement between Oliver Luck and Vince. If Oliver Luck settled for a lot less money than he was trying to get in trial, then maybe that would identify that maybe Oliver Luck also didn't want to go to trial. But we don't know. It could be the case that Vince wanted to avoid trial for some reason to protect himself. Anyway, Wall Street Journal had a podcast. It's not like a terribly long episode. It's something like 15 minutes or so. We listened to it ahead of our company popularity podcast. I'm just going to play a couple clips from it and discuss. So here's one where... This is with Ted Mann, who is one of the authors of the original report that came out from the Wall Street Journal on June 15th. And this is discussing the relationship and the sort of the power that the board has or doesn't have over Vince McMahon.
Is to ultimately hire and fire the CEO of the company.
Mm-hmm.
But if many members of the board are also employees of the CEO of the company, it creates the potential for a conflict of interest because they may not want to go against what the CEO wants because they could ultimately lose their jobs.
Sure.
And not only that, because McMahon owns so many shares of the company, theoretically,
if the board wants to fire him as CEO, there's nothing to stop the person who controls the voting from firing the board because Vince McMahon controls the company.
Okay, so that's Ted Mann talking there at the end, again, saying that if the board wants to fire Vince as CEO, there's nothing to stop Vince, who has controlling interest in the stock, which he does, from firing the board. So again, Vince has about 2/3 of the shares, but because he has Class B shares, he has 80% of the votes. I'm not sure that that's correct. I don't think that Vince can fire the board. Vince can elect the board every April, and he does by virtue of having 80% of the votes. I don't know what the process is for electing the board, but I don't think that Vince can just fire members of the board of directors at any time he chooses. Perhaps he could do something the following April to install new members of the board, assuming that he still held more than 50% of the votes. So that's one thing. And I also believe that, as we discussed before, based on, if nothing else, Vince's employment agreement, which as far as I can tell is still valid and we're still looking at the most up-to-date version of it, there's a section in it headed termination by the company that says the company may terminate the executive's employment under this agreement, and it lists a number of conditions that it can fire the executive, Vince McMahon, with or without cause. So I think the board can fire him. Whether they will, not saying that they will, but I do believe that's in their power. And maybe Vince could, you know, by the following shareholders meeting, reinstall himself as CEO. Maybe, if other events did not prevent that. But I do believe the board has that power. And I've tried to get in touch with Ted Mann to discuss that, but I haven't heard back yet. So then we have this other clip where they're discussing one of the risk factors that we see in the annual report every year is that if Vince becomes incapacitated or passes away, that's a big risk factor that could affect the value of the company. So here's, again, this is with the host, Ryan Knutson and Ted Mann talking about that subject.
If this does result in Vince McMahon stepping down or moving aside or losing some control over the company, what would that mean for WWE?
If you just look at what the company says to investors, they say Vince McMahon is so central to their programming that it's a threat to your investment in buying a share of their stock if he were to ever go away. So just taking that alone, the company says they need this guy. He's central to their programming. He's central to what they sell, and that it would be a big hit to them. But, you know, that's never been tested. We don't really know if that's true.
Chris Cole, is that true?
We've only known a WWE with Vince McMahon. You know?
What's the case for that being true? What does Vince provide for WWE that is so valuable?
I think stability and experience and, you know, like, for example, the head of creative position, you know, there has never been anybody really in that head of creative position. Yeah, we've heard other names before, the head writer, but Vince is the head of creative, and he always has been. And I would imagine as an investor of stock, change is not always a good thing. You have a company that has growing. The stock price is healthy. The TV deals, big TV deals are coming, and all that could be affected if you take Vince out. Does the Saudi Arabia deal go away? There's a lot of factors for that.
There may be key person agreements that would allow some of WWE's business partners to revisit if Vince was no longer a part of the company. That's possible. I think experience is the strongest attribute for making an argument that Vince is extremely important to WWE. It's kind of opaque to me what his involvement really is beyond being the head of creative. I tend to think that Nick Khan and others have assumed more of his non-head of creative duties over the years. And I think that Nick Khan is very much the one who does and will negotiate WWE's media rights deals. The head of creative, has there ever been a product or a brand or some sort of WWE product that was overseen creatively by someone other than Vince McMahon and was operated mostly independently of Vince McMahon?
I would only think of developmentals, which would be NXT under Triple H and maybe like OVW or something like that, but probably NXT would be the biggest example of that.
And how did NXT go?
Vince ended up replacing him with people that have a similar vision that he does.
But how did it go? How did it go from what was NXT in 2014 and then what was NXT in, let's say, 2018?
Oh, it went from, you know, a true developmental that was on Hulu that had little interest to being something that was packing arenas and, you know, on the USA Network and very revered, especially among the internet wrestling fans.
And that was done without Vince. I mean, apparently. Very little oversight from Vince.
Yeah.
I think Vince is a big detriment to creative. Replacing him would be a political battle. And I don't know. I have become less confident over the last year or two that someone in Vince's place would actually do a better job. But I think one of the biggest detriment to WWE enhancing its popularity and its consumer sales and its consumer engagement is the quality of the creative, which is entirely Vince's responsibility. And I think this is very much a business partner idea, or at least it is a public perception from wrestling fans all the way through to the most mainstream naive view of this company, that without Vince, wow, this company's really going to be in trouble, and we've never known a WWE without Vince McMahon. And I think that's very overrated. So anyway, there's that. There's the board of directors.
At Parker, our purpose is simple. We want to make the world a better place. By working more efficiently, by using more sustainable practices, by developing better technologies, we keep moving forward. With each new idea, innovation, and partnership, we're one step closer to fulfilling our purpose every single day. To find out more, visit parker.com/purpose. Parker, engineering your success.
Then we have some news coming on, this is Monday night. Yeah, Monday night going into Tuesday morning. Wow, a 3:23 a.m. tweet from John Pollock at Post Wrestling. John Pollock doesn't sleep, apparently.
And sleep is the enemy.
What does he say, Golo?
Memo regarding John Laurinaitis sent to Post Wrestling from source. John Laurinaitis has been placed on administrative leave pending the conclusion of our board of directors' internal investigation. Bruce Pritchard will serve as interim head of talent relations. Bruce will ensure a seamless operational transition with the talent relations team during this period. Thank you, as always. Story first reported at PW Insider.
Okay. So, John Laurinaitis, who, by the way, it's easy to leave his name out here. I think we have up to this point. John Laurinaitis is also involved in this scandal. Former paralegal, used to work for WWE, worked under Vince, had her salary doubled. She allegedly had a sexual relationship with Vince. Vince made an agreement with her for $3 million for her to sign an NDA to not talk about or disparage Vince McMahon. According to documents, according to Wall Street Journal, she was handed like a toy to John Laurinaitis, who she also had a sexual relationship with. So he's being put on administrative leave pending the conclusion of the investigation. Vince McMahon is, for the moment, no longer the CEO and chairman, at least officially, pending the investigation. Bruce Pritchard, who is not a new addition to this company, he's been executive director. He's very involved in creative, now taking on additional roles here. So that's what's happening. I think of Bruce Pritchard as a close ally of Vince McMahon. If Vince McMahon, you know, by Monday is supposedly no longer the CEO, Bruce Pritchard being given additional responsibility doesn't encourage my belief that Vince is really out of power here. It only the opposite. Feel free to interrupt me if you disagree, Golo.
No, I don't disagree. I'm trying to think. I think one other time, if I'm correctly, Bruce was basically a transitional talent relations, but between J.J. Dillon and Jim Ross, I think. If I'm mistaken.
Mid-90s?
Yes. Right? Yeah.
So he has experience in the role, nonetheless. There's a Fightful report where someone joked, you know, Vince McMahon only knows three people. Anyway. But then on, this is Wednesday, another tweet report from John Pollock of Post Wrestling. And what does that say?
According to multiple sources, Paul Levesque was in Orlando today and spoke at the Performance Center. Of the people I've heard from, Levesque stated, he's back. It's unknown what that entails, but that was the wording I was given.
So if Paul Levesque is reassuming some power, maybe that would be maybe supportive of a belief that, you know, Stephanie has more power here. Well, maybe that makes sense. Her husband is back in a role that he hadn't been in. And yes, sure, health issues have probably played a role in why he was not in the position that he was in. But I believe that he was taken out of power in NXT around 1 year ago in the summer of 2021 because of disappointment with how NXT was performing. In terms of ratings, in terms of its ability to attract a better media rights deal than it had in the first place, beginning in 2019. But supposedly he's back. I did ask one person about this who used to work with Triple H, who said that it's, that they don't believe that this is real, but we'll see what happens here. We'll see if NXT 3.0 is launched soon. So let's see here. And then this report from PW Insider about Stephanie McMahon. I did hear this too, that at least there was an all-hands meeting with Nick Khan, the president and chief revenue officer of WWE. Nick Khan and Stephanie hosted this all-hands meeting. And I was told that the theme of it was that everything is normal, everything is continuing to move on, despite what's happening with Vince. And why don't you read us this final paragraph here that we have?
Yep. PWInsider.com is also told, as of this week, Stephanie has been actively involved in meetings that usually have seen Vince McMahon taking part.
Okay, and so if that's true, I mean, that would be consistent with the notion that Vince really is stepping away from some of his responsibilities and Stephanie in her place. So,
could they be compromising? Could they be honestly basically working together on this? You know, Vince doesn't want to really give full power. So it's like, hey, I'm going to put Bruce in paternal relations and stuff. He's like, that's okay, but I really think Paul should go back to NXT. That's the vision I want. Like, do you think that might have been a compromise move?
And anything is possible in the World Wrestling Federation.
Yeah.
So there's that. I was thinking, I don't think I've said this on the podcast yet. You know, I was thinking, you know, maybe Stephanie, this is one possible explanation for what's happened here, with Stephanie being the CEO and chairwoman. She's not the only person who I could imagine being made interim CEO, right? I could see just as easily Nick Khan being placed as the interim CEO. That wouldn't have been surprising either, right? But Stephanie gets the pick here after she had just announced a leave of absence. Whether or not she knew about this investigation or not, I would guess that she does. But Stephanie gets the pick as CEO. And who decided who the CEO and chairwoman in the interim would be? Probably Vince would be my expectation. And maybe that just points to Vince trusting Stephanie the most, maybe trusting Stephanie more than Nick. Test your might memes aside. So that's interesting to see. As I've been talking about a lot, what determines the degree to which there is real accountability, and what will determine the degree to which WWE removes Vince or doesn't, if there is real wrongdoing here, which, you know, he had a relationship with a subordinate, that at least is inappropriate. What determines whether there's accountability or not is largely in the hands of mainstream media. Ultimately, the responsibility, of course, is with the board of directors and with Vince and the people who have power in WWE. But what will pressure them or not will be the mainstream media, which will pressure if they report on it and if they're actually able to break news about this. They will ultimately pressure WWE's business partners. And business partners will then pressure WWE and its board to actually do something. That is how, if it happens, Vince will permanently lose power, if it happens. But there hasn't really been any new mainstream coverage here in this past week. Am I missing something?
No, I haven't heard anything from, like, the ESPNs and the CNNs or anything like that.
Yeah. There is that podcast from the Wall Street Journal, which we just played clips of from. Maybe the Wall Street Journal will do more following up on this. But I do expect a story in Vulture, the New York Magazine vertical, with something from Abraham Reisman, who's the biographer, the writer who's working on a book about Vince McMahon's life, which I understand that the timeline of the book is going to stop well short of the present, so maybe there's some extra information that doesn't fit in the book that might end up as articles, but we'll see. Sort of expect that maybe next week or so. Any other thoughts here before we go to Forbidden Door?
No, we can open that Forbidden Door now.
Are you sure you want to open it? are you wearing your all of your padded gear? Are you wearing your helmet?
Got my baseball bat ready.
Are you going to watch Forbidden Door tonight?
I've debated on it. There's a couple. I have a couple options that people have offered it to me. But you know what I mean? I'm getting that old man territory. Unless it's something that really grabbing towards me, I might just sit and watch the History Channel tonight. You know, but I mean, it's something I will watch within a week if I don't watch it live. There's a couple matches that really
interest me. How would you watch it if you don't watch it live? You know, you're going to order the pay-per-view later.
Yes. Yeah, you can. You can. It's on demand. Yeah,
you're gonna pay the $50. You're gonna be one of those late buys.
You can watch it on demand at any time. You know, so you don't have to sit live. Who knows how long it's gonna be?
So a lot of injuries, obviously, going into this. CM Punk out. Bryan Danielson out. I don't think Jungle Boy was scheduled for, but Jungle Boy is injured too. Many of AEW's most searched for wrestlers. I don't know if this necessarily means that they're the biggest draws, but this is maybe a good place to start. The most recognizable names is probably a more apt description of what we're looking at here. We have Google Trends, worldwide Google Trends index for AEW talent on the screen here. Number one, Paige VanZant. Maybe known for reasons other than AEW primarily, though. Paul White. Nobody believes this because Paul White is at the top. How can that be? This has got to be fake. Nonetheless, Paul White is number two. Followed by, this is year-to-date, by the way. Followed by CM Punk, Jeff Hardy. This is not including June, so this would not include any searching that's happening because of the arrest story. Jeff Hardy, John Moxley, Chris Jericho, Tony Storm, Bryan Danielson, MJF, Mark Henry, Jade Cargill, Sting, Danhausen, Kenny Omega, Dustin Rhodes, Adam Cole, Matt Hardy. I think that's something like 17 names. How many of those names? So this is maybe the most recognizable names who are AEW talent. How many of those names are going to be on this card tonight?
Four, I believe.
Moxley, Jericho, Tony Storm,
Sting. Then it's five, and Adam Cole.
And Adam Cole. So, Hiromu not making it. There was a media call this past, I believe Thursday, where Tony Khan took questions from the media. He had a very long answer to a question about all the injuries. But what I thought was really the most newsworthy part of this, I had planned to ask various questions that were ultimately asked by others before I got on the call about pay-per-view and things like that. But then Sean Radican from The Torch asked about whether there was a wellness policy in the light of, you know, John Moxley went to rehab. And he seems to be doing much better now. There's a, I think, a really good story in ESPN from Mark Raimondi a couple days ago, talking about his whole experience and what led exactly the story of him, you know, deciding that he had to go to rehab and what it was like there, and you know, how he felt afterward, which I think was a nice story. So considering that, and considering, you know, Jeff Hardy just got arrested for DUI, is there a wellness policy anyway? Here's the clip with Sean Radican speaking first, and then Tony Khan answering, and we'll pause it as we go.
John Moxley recently talked to ESPN about his experience going to rehab for alcohol problems, and with your recent statement coming out about Jeff Hardy's suspension after being arrested for a DUI, have you thought about instituting any kind of wellness policy in AEW given some of the recent occurrences, or is there something in place already that you haven't talked about? I was just wondering if you could shed a little
light. We have a wellness policy, but in the case of drinking, I think it's, you have to be really careful, because most people, I think, you know, 99% of the rosters drank really responsibly, and I think most people drink really responsibly.
Okay, so there he's basically saying that he doesn't feel like he can test for alcohol and things like that, and that most people use alcohol responsibly. He goes on to talk about how he doesn't want to compare the Moxley story to the Jeff Hardy story, because, you know, Moxley didn't get into legal trouble or anything like that. Moxley volunteered for rehab, whereas, you know, Jeff Hardy was arrested for DUI. So then he talks. He's about to go to the next question, then he stops the moderator and wants to say a little bit more, but here's an excerpt of that. You just talk about how Jeff is doing now.
Jeff is doing much better. And I think, as I understand, Jeff's in treatment, and I don't want to say too much about what's going on because it's his business, but I'm here for him for whatever he needs. I'm really glad nobody got hurt. But what Jeff did going out and driving is totally different from the other thing, and I just don't like hearing the two of them compared, if that makes sense. And I feel like I'd be remiss if I didn't give Jeff a lot of credit for now doing the right thing. And this is how he said, Jeff's got to do the right thing, and if he wants to stay with AEW, because it's last chance saloon, man.
So, anyway, what he said in response to Radican's question earlier is that there's a wellness policy, which was brand news to me. I don't think he had ever alluded to that or said that publicly. I had wondered for a long time whether AEW had any wellness policy. So I asked him some questions about that, which we'll listen to.
You mentioned a moment ago that AEW has a wellness policy. I was wondering if you could tell us anything more about that, if that involves drug testing or any specifics about how talent would be disciplined or offered help if they violate.
Yeah, yes, I'm glad you asked. I think the most important thing that I will elaborate on is that we're here to help anybody that needs it. And I hope I made it really clear with the tone I took just now, and also with the stern tone I took following Jeff's arrest compared to how I felt and feel about how John has stepped up and how he stepped up and got help. We're here for anybody that steps up and wants to get help, and hopefully they'll come to us instead of it being under a circumstance where they get themselves in trouble. But the most important thing is that they get the help, and I'm here to stand by anybody that needs help, and we'll get it. So I think the big point I would note is that it's available to anybody here, that anybody needs time off. If they have an issue, they can take it, no matter how big a star they are. It could be the most important person in the company in terms of drawing revenue, or somebody who is not on TV as much and doesn't draw as much revenue. It doesn't matter. We're here to get them the same quality of first-class treatment if they need it. And then, as far as everything else, I think, we do have policies in place about, making sure people come in and come show up and show up to work in the condition to work, and that's the most important thing. And then, there's a testing policy, and in particular, I just want to stress that we are here to offer help to anybody that needs it, but that like I said, hopefully they would come to us and not get in trouble and then come to us.
Okay. So there's that. There isn't an opportunity to ask follow-up questions on the media call. You sort of, they unmute you, you ask your question, and then they mute you and he responds. So I'd be really interested to know what kind of testing policy there is. This is all new information. There is a testing policy, Tony Khan says. Is this random testing? Is this just testing for cause when you observe and suspect that somebody has a problem? Not clear to me. So, and he makes it clear that this is Jeff Hardy's last chance. I don't know if it was clear on the clip itself, but he makes it clear that Jeff had to go to rehab. It sounds like otherwise, he would have been terminated. So that's what's happening there. I also wanted to know about discipline, too. Like, is there some sort of three-strike policy like WWE purportedly has? What is the discipline process like? Is there a policy about you have to go to rehab, and if you don't go to rehab, we release you or anything like that? Oh, no. Any other thoughts on that?
No, I mean, that's the thing. Just that we don't really know what the policy is. I mean, I would assume it's just situational. I don't think it's just, hey, we test once a month and all that. But also when it comes to DUI.
What substances would they test for? Yeah.
When it comes to DUI and DWI backlash, you hear about the WWE cases when it happens once in a while, but you don't really hear much afterwards if there's a suspension or a fine or something like that. We've had a couple cases in the past with WWE, so not sure if we would get that from AEW if they did talk a little more publicly about the wellness policy.
Right. So Jimmy Uso was arrested for DUI, looks like in April. And we don't know of any discipline that happened there.
Yeah.
So anyway,
We did get a super chat that was AEW related. It came in literally right when we were transitioning to the Vince McMahon stuff on the ratings. But it's from Tim B here. Was TK's decision to deny a third hour of Dynamite for Rampage a mistake? Would a 3-hour Dynamite with a third hour dragging down the rating be better?
A 3-hour Dynamite with a third hour dragging down the rating be better? I don't know. I think no. I think having a second program is a big deal because it gives you a second property, a second TV show that you could potentially sell to a business partner, to a TV network, as opposed to having a longer show. Not only is there this, now I think clearly the stigma with wrestling fans, at least, that, you know, 3-hour Raw is one of the things that hinders people's fandom, and that it's too long and things like that. Get what maybe Tim is getting at here in terms of, I get maybe two things in that the situation with ratings would be better, and you know the common criticism about Dynamite is that there's so much going on and it's all happening too fast and they're packing too much into this show, and maybe a third hour would alleviate that. I don't know. I mean, but we've already got a 2-hour Dynamite and a 1-hour Rampage. I don't know that it would be that much different other than the 3 hours would be consecutive rather than broken up by 2 days. Would the rating be... I mean, the rating would be lower, definitely, because it would be at 10 to 11, which would, I don't know, make it maybe a tougher sell to networks, and you'd have less to highlight and brag about because your rating wouldn't be as strong. And again, I think the lesson of 2018, thanks to Nick Khan, is that there's leverage for a wrestling company or, you know, any sports property. The NFL is, you know, the most developed example, perhaps, right, where they sell to all these different TV partners, and they surely get a lot more money because of it. But where in 2018... Raw and SmackDown went from both being on the USA Network, both being owned by NBC Universal, to selling SmackDown off to Fox and Raw staying with NBC Universal. So I always think of it as, you know, you're selling it in bulk for less or selling it, you know, sort of piecemeal to multiple buyers. You know, when you go to the grocery store, you can buy the extra large size and it's a little bit less per unit, or you can buy a couple of smaller boxes and you pay more. So I think there's a lot of leverage for AEW to get if they can sell a second property. And again, the way it's playing out and the way it seems most advantageous to me, I don't know if there's buyers there or not in the streaming world for a Rampage program, but that's where it apparently makes the most sense to me. I don't think in the Turner world that there's any place else to put it where it wouldn't be preempted a lot other than stepping way down to a lower profile network, which is going to really harm the viewership. So you might as well go to streaming, and rather than going to, say, True TV, put Rampage on True TV where it's not going to be preempted, for instance, where you're not enhancing the reach, you're lowering the profile of the network, as opposed to going to a streaming platform where you should be enhancing the reach if it's the right streaming platform, so that you get Rampage in these homes that don't have cable access, and now you can have a wider base of fans, in theory, and maybe you can get that streaming platform to pay you more than a TV network would because of the total reach is less. Rampage would perhaps end up even less viewed on a streaming platform, yes, but maybe it's going to be hitting people that it wouldn't be hitting otherwise, where it is now on TNT, and maybe you can get more money because of this, because of sacrificing the total number of people that it can reach.
Yeah, I think as time goes on, it's going to be tougher because it seems like there is a push to get maybe more sports media rights now after this Discovery Worm merger. And you're not just talking TNT, but True TV could start having live sports. And so even going to True TV would...
I doubt that's going to... Like, is there like a store? Like, why do you think that?
I mean, I think the obviously, you know, we... programming that makes sense. I mean, sports programming isn't cheap, but the ratings it delivers, I mean, it looked like they're focused on going to get sports and, you know, reality television, you know.
I think Warner Brothers Discovery is going to focus on sports, and it's going to focus on unscripted series.
Yeah, unscripted series, yeah.
Don't say reality TV.
Yeah, sorry.
Did you say I didn't mean that?
I actually did, but I was trying to. It wasn't coming to my mind, the unscripted series. But just because, I mean, you know, obviously, you know, there's a lot of contenders out there for sports, but it could get to a point where they need to put a sports property on True TV.
I guess what I'm trying to get at is keep in mind, remember those clips we listened to several weeks back from the Discovery Warner conference call with the CFO and with the CEO, David Zaslav, where they're preaching cost discipline, and they're talking about looking under the hood at Warner Media and finding investments that is programming that doesn't make sense, that doesn't make financial sense in their view. And that's why CNN Plus went away, and that may be why Discovery is going to be a lot more cautious than maybe other networks would be when it comes to making TV deals. So that is the big CON case against the notion that AEW is going to be able to leverage strong TV rights fees because perhaps their incumbent partner isn't interested in bidding aggressively because they're being very cautious and assessing perhaps that everybody in this game is overspending and it's not worth that much. Everybody's overspending for streaming, but maybe streaming is not going to be as profitable as traditional TV. So what are we spending for?
We also have to remember, too, we're talking about Rampage. I mean, we're under the belief that Tony Khan also is right now trying to shop a Ring of Honor show around, too, whether that's going to be on a streaming service or a Warner Discovery Network.
Right. Okay.
And we'll move on to more TV rights talks.
Yes. Tell us what John O'Ran reported this week about Formula One.
Yep. So F1 has agreed to renew its rights with ESPN through 2025. Sources tell the Sports Business Journal. The 3-year deal still doesn't have a signed contract, but the racing series told Amazon and Comcast executives on Friday that neither company's bid was going to be accepted. Sources say that ESPN agreed to pay around $75 to $90 million per year for the rights. Currently, ESPN pays in the neighborhood of $5 million per year for the rights, having signed a 3-year $15 million deal in 2019. ESPN's deal gives the media rights flexibility to put a small but undetermined number of races exclusively on ESPN Plus streaming service. Most races will be carried on linear television, either ABC or ESPN, sources said.
Okay. So Formula One, I believe I've done the math here. They were getting around $5 million before. Now they're getting somewhere between $75 and $90 million. That represents a 15 to 18x increase. What did WWE get for their current deal? What factor of increase was WWE's current deal over its prior deal?
Was it 1.5?
3.6x. Nick Khan comes in there.
Yeah, that's right.
He doesn't get 1.4x, 1.5x. They got 1.7x back in 2015. More than tripling. So that's what I was talking about earlier. You take SmackDown and sell it to a different buyer, and then sell Raw to the incumbent buyer, more than tripled WWE's US TV rights fees. That's why Rampage having a separate TV show, I think, is really important. And this, 15 to 18 times. Now, Formula One has had a surge in popularity, coinciding with the Netflix series Drive to Survive. And some of the biggest ratings for Formula One races ever have happened in the last year. So their ratings have really strongly improved. So this is not just a sort of status quo where we're stable and good. This property has really increased in value. And what we're seeing in the media rights for that property is a mega increase in value for it. 15 to 18 times. Baseline, based on the math we did a while back. Yes, I'm going to say we. You helped me with that, Chris Golo. 1.5x is what I...
That's where that number was stuck in my head. Yes.
So that's a baseline expectation. Yeah. That's our baseline expectation. 1.5x for WB. I think we went as high as 4 to 5 for AEW. We'll see. So there's that. Some of these races will be on ESPN Plus. Some of them will be on streaming. I think that makes sense. You want to reach sort of what I was talking about earlier with maybe Dynamite on traditional, Rampage on streaming in the future, perhaps. Some of these races are going to be on. Most of these races are going to be on traditional ESPN. Some of these races will be on ESPN Plus, so you're reaching as many people as possible that way. And what has Nick Khan told us on those earnings calls? It's only a matter of time before Apple gets involved. It's only a matter of time before Netflix gets involved. By the way, I believe it is Sports Business Journal reporting that Netflix made a bid, but it was too low. Now, when it comes to NFL Sunday Ticket, have you ever subscribed to NFL Sunday Ticket?
Yes, back when I had DirecTV with my old roommate back, this is probably like 2012, 2013, but yes.
Okay.
Did subscribe to Sunday Ticket back then.
It's been only on DirecTV up to this point, right? It's been always only been on DirecTV?
As far as I can remember, maybe it was different in the 90s, but as far as I can remember being a football fan, it was always on DirecTV.
So if I don't have DirecTV, if I don't have cable or satellite, is there a streaming option through DirecTV?
We don't know.
Okay.
Yeah.
So anyway,
it's an add-on. It was always an add-on, though. Part of the whole package, yeah.
For sure. So anyway, those rights are coming to an end, and they're being shopped around by the NFL. Alex Sherman from CNBC reports that the NFL wants a winning bid of more than $2 billion. I don't know if that's AAV or if that's over the course of some years. Anyway, Apple, Amazon, and ESPN have all bid, but talks with all three continue. Apple wants global rights, DirecTV not bidding, but open to agreement with the winner. Okay. And the package must be premium priced. That's what Alex Sherman is tweeting. I believe Lightshed has said that they believe it's going to go to Apple. We'll see.
And Apple just got MLS, right? I think you might have touched on that the week I was off.
Yeah, I don't think we talked about that at all. But yeah, that's I think Vince, all hell was breaking loose with Vince at that time. Okay. But yes, MLS going to Apple. All of it.
Yep.
Maybe some of these games are still going to be on ESPN. But yeah, other than that, all of it going from ESPN to Apple. Apple already has Friday Night Baseball. So Apple definitely getting involved here. Is Apple going to bid for wrestling? I doubt it. Is Amazon going to... We'll see. We're still waiting for... Could happen at any moment, right? Next day.
Yeah. That should be news soon.
Yes. And what gets sold, assuming neither of these companies get acquired by you know, NBC, Comcast, or maybe AEW by Warner Brothers Discovery, which seems less likely now that those companies have merged. But anyway, what gets sold by AEW? Do they just sell the live rights in a certain window? I mean, what I'm getting at here is AEW has never sold, and nobody owns next day rights, or maybe Warner does in some way, and they're just not using it. But there's no way to watch Dynamite or Rampage the next day in any way other than recording it with your DVR through your cable system, or maybe some illegal way.
You can't watch it on the TNT or TBS apps.
Maybe that's something.
I believe I've watched them Saturday mornings, Rampage on the TNT app and stuff. Yeah,
Right. But what I'm saying is that that's another way to segment this stuff. You know, you segment not only what I was saying earlier, Rampage to a streaming player, Dynamite to a traditional player, and maybe segment the rights after 24 hours to some Hulu-like partner or something like that. That's what WWE has done, right? And that's just segmenting all these different ways to sell all these different pieces and windows of your content to all these different players. Anyway, that's all I have.
Oh, yeah, but and then that is all I have for this week as well.
Mm-hmm. I do have this list of... I'm looking for... I've debated putting this out here. I have... I'm looking for somebody who can do graphics for us. If you have a special graphics talent and you're interested in helping us, DM me. Or if you're good at video editing, the ideal person would be good at all these things. Maybe TikTok. Bring podcast timestamps for us doing graphics and perhaps some video editing as well. I don't want to tweet this. I want people who actually listen to the podcast involved, maybe. Mm-hmm. We'll see. So Patreon, of course, is always there. Patreon.com/WrestleNomics. You can get my TV ratings reports that come out nearly every weekday. You also get access to the WrestleNomics viewership spreadsheet. You also get access to occasional audio versions and company popularity updates that we've been doing lately. Golo thinks we're doing it monthly. We'll see. As well as the Who's a Draw, possibly monthly premium edition. This is all those things only for subscribers. There is no free version of those. There will not be. I just did a subscribers now have access to a beta version of the YouTube data that I've been putting together, where you can look at any moment you want. Look at what the YouTube charts look like over the past 7 days for the WWE and AEW programs, as well as a non-WWE and AEW version. So anyway, that's all I have.
We got a last minute super chat.
Oh.
Tim B, thank you, Tim. Second super chat today. Are you surprised that AEW has created long-form bios/reality shows of talent like a WWE 24 series? So I think I may read that they have, because they really haven't, right? Or have they?
Is that supposed to be hasn't?
Yeah, that's what I'm assuming.
Thank you, Tim B. Who's going to buy it? It's. I think they look at it as that's a relatively expensive thing to invest in. Okay, that's a relatively expensive thing to produce. It's not you can't just produce it for free, and. It'd be a great marketing tool, right? You tell the story of some talent and you get people invested. But there has to be a payoff. There has to be somebody buying that or licensing that, you know? I think that's how they view it, especially at this stage. While their TV rights value is good, but not super great. And I think, you know, you look at what WWE is doing in terms of the what they've licensed to A&E. You know, where did the Lex Luger documentary go? Where did the Vlad the Superfan documentary go? I think they've made a calculation that, hey, look, Peacock is basically paying us for the pay-per-views and they're paying us for the library. So why are we spending to do other things? They're not going to give us more because we produce these documentaries when maybe we can give them some stuff here and there, and maybe they still are without searching. I think they are still giving Peacock a little bit of additional content.
Yeah.
But
I mean, they get the Austin show and, you know, Broken Skull and a few things like that.
So why not take these documentaries that are, you know, decent investments and license that out to A&E, who will, you know, pay us a good chunk of money for it. And there's they're going to do some sort of unscripted thing, I believe, for in place of Road to the Top, which obviously isn't going forward.
I was going to bring that up, that do they have to still honor that, or maybe now with the merger, they're like, we don't need a reality series right now. Like,
I believe something has been said that they're going to do something, some sort of unscripted series, you know, and then everybody's identifying what we just talked about with Formula One and Drive to Survive. Drive to Survive is Netflix series that a lot of people have gotten into and have developed into real Formula One fans because of. We're actually watching races now, including our friends John and Way at Post Wrestling, who've been talking about that lately. So anyway. All right.
Yeah, but just for me, you know, Chris Gello on all the social media handles, RTI Pod, Instagram and Twitter. Rediscovering His Facebook. We'll have our final part of our Burt Prentice deep dive out later this week, and then we're going to move on next month to a new topic, thinking about possibly doing a biopiece on Reckless Youth Tom Carter. So, on that Independent Wrestling History podcast. Yeah.
Okay. I guess we say near the end here. So this pay per view that's tonight. I won't weigh in, but I'll let you weigh in. What do you think this is going to do for pay-per-view buys? What did the last one do?
Wasn't it 135, right?
I'm going to pull it up right now. We won't put it on the screen because I don't have it. It's not like a slide, but it's in the... So Double or Nothing is in the range of 155. Revolution in the range of 165. Full Gear, about 145. All Out, about 205. These are not exact numbers, but these are what I believe is the case based on vague information I've been told, because I don't think they want the exact numbers out there.
I'm going to say it's definitely taking a drop. I'm going to say about 130.
130?
Yeah, I think there's something to be said in a deeper dive of the injuries, but like, is New Japan a real huge marketable product to the common casual fan?
The casual fan.
Yeah, like, so I think there's some a deep dive that could be done on that. I think it's someone watches wrestling here or there when they hear, oh, CM Punk's back, I guess I got to tune into that. Somebody that was a huge fan at one time, and life, you know, they got busy, and now they'll just chime in for the big moments.
So my casual fan?
No, I mean, you watch at least one wrestling program weekly, correct?
I don't know. Yeah. I make the labels for the quarter hours.
Yeah.
Does that count?
I think you're a little more than casual.
Anyway, okay. We'll see what happens there. We'll talk to everybody next time. Thanks to Post Wrestling, as always, for being our distribution partner. And see you later.
Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you'll get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matters more than ever. Place your money line, prop, or parlay bets with the king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park.